the industry is not as capital short as the industry pretends to be. One immediate aftermath of the conference was a reaffirmation to me from high net worth clients that they had equity available for the sector as long as we felt that the equity would be treated well by the investors.
This episode of MiningStockEducation.com is brought to you by Sandstorm Gold Royalties. Sandstorm Gold Royalties is a different kind of gold company. They purchase royalties on select mining operations and receive a percentage of the revenue in return. Sandstorm now has a portfolio of nearly 190 gold royalties around the world. See how gold royalties differ from other gold mining investments at SandstormGold.com. That's SandstormGold.com. Sandstorm Gold Royalties trades on the TSX as SSL and on the NYSE American as S-A-N-D. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for tuning in to another Mining Stock Education Expert interview. And this episode, hopefully like all of them, will be educational. I have someone on the line that we all know very well if we're anywhere familiar with resource investing, and that's Mr. Rick Rule, the president and CEO of Sprott US Holdings. So Rick, thanks for taking the time and coming on the show.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Rick, I met you in person a couple times this year. The last time was at your own conference in July in Vancouver, the Sprott Natural Resource Symposium. At that time, I asked you what you were learning during the conference. It was, I believe, at the end of day two, and you told me to follow up with you a little bit down the line so you could consume your own cooking, listen to the MP3s of the conference. So with that being said, what did you learn from your own conference?
Well, I relearned an important lesson, which is the importance of people in any business, but particularly in the exploration business, which you'll remember that we described as more of a research, sort of a human resources intensive rather than a physical resources intensive business. And if you look at who the winners and losers have been since that conference, it's obvious once again that great people have carried the show. The second thing that I learned on reflection, but also looking at my notes from the conference and listening to the MP3s, is that the industry is not as capital short as the industry pretends to be. One immediate aftermath of the conference was a reaffirmation to me from high net worth clients that they had equity available for the sector as long as we felt that the equity would be treated well by the investors. Subsequent to that, you may know that Sprott has embarked on its second institutional lending partnership, where we're targeting about $1 billion from existing and new institutional investors. And it looks as though we will achieve that goal. So the idea that the industry puts forward that it's somehow underfunded, I think is false. I think the industry is used to being overfunded and has a preference for dumb money over smart money. But one thing that we learned from the conference and subsequent to that is that there's lots of money around for good projects. It's also interesting to note, and we talked about this at the conference, that one of our chief competitors, by ours, I mean Sprott's chief competitors, in terms of doing fundings now, is other mining companies. So rather than competing as sources of capital with generalist institutions, that is, people who might be more comfortable in supermarket investing or technology investing, we're competing directly with the industry, which, while that's hard on Sprott, because they're better competitors, certainly augurs to the fact that the smart money, mining money, is returning to mining too. All of which are, I think, useful points.
I have some follow-up questions as it relates to deciding who you're going to partner with, mining company management. When you're interviewing a management team that you have not partnered with before, you don't have a reputation with them, you don't know them that well, and maybe they don't have a track record of success behind them. Maybe it's a younger CEO starting out. What are some things that you're going to look at in a younger, unproven CEO that would cause you to maybe consider investing in his or her company?
If I don't know him or her, I better know a couple people who do. It's a fairly small business, and if somebody hasn't proven themselves with their own friends, they're not going to prove themselves with my clients. I remember going back many, many, many years, we wrote one of the startup checks for a great junior success called Altius Minerals. The CEO at that time was a 23-year-old, painfully skinny prospector from Newfoundland, Brian Dalton, that wasn't known in financial markets. But it turned out that he was extremely well known in exploration markets in Newfoundland, the two geologists that generated the Voisey's Bay nickel deposit, Chislett and Verbisky. They became legendary. Both knew and vouched for this young man extraordinarily. So if I don't know the person, I better know somebody who does know them, or else the chances of them getting some money from Sprott are nil.
When you're querying a newer CEO that you're being introduced to, do you sometimes ask them regarding their knowledge of mining history or past successful mining promoters or CEOs?
Well, I normally ask other people about them. In other words, allowing them to tell me good things about themselves is something that you have to endure. That's something that promoters do. But I'm much more interested in hearing them tell me the names of people that I already know who I can query them about that. The next thing that you do, having had them pass the sniff test, in other words, having had people who know them, who I know, vouch for them, is I try and figure out what it is on their resume, however short their resume might be, that qualifies them specifically for the task at hand, understanding that the process of exploration is very much a research and development process. It's about answering a series of unanswered questions. And what I want to know then about the CEO is his or her resume sufficient that I care about the thesis that they might have developed? And do I believe that they have enough experience answering the same kinds of questions that the method by which they propose to test the thesis is both efficacious, in other words, will it answer the question, and efficient, which means will it answer the question reasonably from an economic point of view. When somebody says to me that they have been a success in mining, but the part of mining that they have been a success in isn't directly related to the task at hand, I don't equate that prior success with any indication that they may or may not be successful in the future.
I've heard it said that the junior mining sector does not necessarily attract the best CEO talent available. Do you agree with that?
I do. Mining is a small business. It's a business that has been out of favor for a substantial amount of time. And unless you have a real love of geology and exploration, which I happen to do, there are probably other industries with a similar sort of technological bent that one could get into that has more immediate prospects of success. So one of the things that you would look for in a CEO is absolute passion.
In terms of attracting talent and how that correlates to what a junior mining CEO might be paid, I was speaking with a couple fellow investors and we were talking about a particular company and two of us liked the company and the third one chimed in and said, well, that person's being paid too much. Do you think it's right for a junior mining CEO, let's say of an exploration company, market cap, $10 to $30 million being paid $300,000 Canadian? Is that okay if they could justify by saying, hey, we needed to attract talent to run this company?
It depends on how much that CEO has invested in the company. We like to see officers in the company have stock valued at approximately 5 times their annual salary. So in the circumstance that you describe, a $30 million market cap with the CEO earning $300,000 a year, that would be okay with me if I liked every other aspect of that person, provided that they were my partner in the business. In other words, they had substantial capital at risk. I want to make sure that the interests are aligned. If what I am in a highly speculative situation is that I'm in business with a manager as opposed to a partner and a zealot, I have no interest. Someone whose entire interest is in salary will be motivated to maximize salary rather than maximize return on capital employed because they don't have any capital employed.
After our last interview, a listener wrote to me and he said, could I get your take on tin the next time I interview you. He writes, Rio Tinto and other giants are demonstrating that it's the most needed metal in percentage with the most proportionate upside as compared to other base metals. Could you get Rick's take on it?
I won't comment on the most proportional upside because that involves looking too far into the future. And sadly, my crystal ball is cracked and cloudy. It is certainly a metal where the existing deposits that the world is living off of are very long of tooth. And in the context of the alluvial extraction of tin in Asia, enormously environmentally damaging, so that tin production from some historic sources is, mercifully for mankind, failing fast because of the environmental destruction that it does. So I think it's a very, very attractive commodity to be looking for. I will say that trying to play the tin game is difficult because there aren't many listed entities in the tin business. As an example, we are at Sprott taking a substantial amount of risk by backing a tin development in Democratic Republic of Congo, a fairly harsh political and social environment. But we're doing it because the average grade and the scope of this deposit is so large, and we're so fond of tin as a commodity. So I would agree with the general assertion of the caller, although I won't comment specifically on his suggestion that tin has greater upside than any other metal.
As you were mentioning the Congo, I was thinking about something you've said in the past to where you'll take jurisdictional risk if it gets rid of technical risk. So I knew it had to be a tier one asset if you were going into the Congo.
It's absolutely a tier one asset. The Alphaman asset is one that sadly was responsible for some substantial amount of the warlord activity in northeastern Congo. The deposit is of such high grade that artisanal mining on the deposit 10 years ago was rich enough that miners could move run-of-mine material manually on their backs, walking out 2 days to a road where they then smuggled the material into Uganda and Rwanda. It's extraordinarily high-grade material, and there's extraordinary exploration potential. This isn't meant as a promotion of Alphaman. It simply suggests that what you say is true. You know, we would take the risk of operating in a jurisdiction like Congo only in the event that the asset was absolutely tier one, which this one is.
As you look at today, it's the end of 2018. We're about 5 weeks or so away from the new year. You've been at resource investing for 4 decades. What time period most does 2018 going into 2019 remind you of?
You know, I've been asking myself that question a lot, and it reminds me a little bit of a bunch of different periods. But what I've noticed is that every cycle has different features to it, and this one's no different. The bear market, of course, with regards to junior equities, was particularly steep. There's no law that says that the recovery has to match the bear market in either, you know, sort of duration or extent. What is important on the good side with regards to the minerals and the energy business is that we've had substantial supply destruction, meaning that the bear market has destroyed productive capacity so that when markets rebalance to supply and demand and the price begins to go up, the supply won't be able to keep pace because productive capacity is destroyed. That's a very good thing. That's partially counterbalanced because we've been in a general recovery, a general economic expansion for 8 or 9 years. And although I'm not an economist, I wonder if this expansion isn't becoming long of tooth. If you have a general economic slowdown, what that does is constrain supply. So maybe, I'm not saying this is going to occur, but maybe, unfortunately, demand and supply come into balance again as a consequence of both reduced supply and reduced demand. The other thing that I would point out in this instance is that sentiment among generalist investors in most of the world, but particularly in the developed world, with regards to gold, are at multi-decade lows. Gold traditionally has been viewed as a sort of flight to quality asset. And the flight to quality asset that most of the developed world seems to default to now is the U.S. 10-year treasury. I don't believe that gold necessarily will win the war against the U.S. dollar as expressed by the U.S. 10-year treasury. But I do believe that gold will lose the war less badly. And I think that has profound implications for the gold price. I was told, I don't know this to be true, but I believe it was Morgan Stanley or J.P. Morgan that pointed out that in 1981, the top of the last gold cycle, that precious metals and precious metals related assets comprised over 8% of total invested assets in the United States. A similar figure for 2018 is between 1/3 of 1% and 1/2 of 1%. So the market share, if you will, of precious metals and precious metals related securities has fallen from 8% to a top of 1/2 of 1%. The four-decade median or mean in terms of market share of precious metals in the U.S. investable assets market is about 1.5%. So never mind regaining the favor it once had. If it regains the favor that it has traditionally had, in other words, if it reverts to mean, that means that demand for gold and gold-related assets in a market that, while in decline, still has a quarter of the investable assets in the world, that is the United States, would see between a 3- and 4-fold increase in demand for gold or precious metals related assets. And that's what I think is going to occur.
Recently, you were on a panel at a conference and you were asked to rate specific mining investment opportunities. One was the best, 10 was the worst. And at that time, you said you've probably had about 6 ones in your 35 plus years of resource investing. And you defined a one as something that's selling at half of what you think it's worth, a tier one deposit, a management team that you know and love, and an upcoming catalyst. Now, three of those four I could see out there, that being a catalyst, a good management team, a tier one deposit, but that one quality, something that's selling at half of what you think it's worth, are there any of those out there right now for you?
There are no ones in my list right now. Ones are extremely rare. Trying to think of, well, one example of a one would have been in late 2015 when Ivanhoe Mines, two tier one deposits, a promoter who I certainly know and love, he's made my clients an awful lot of money, selling at 60 cents a share with 93 cents a share in cash, contributed by two partners, one Jock Mech, which is basically a parastatal arm of the government of Japan, and the other being Zijin Mining. That's one that was selling at a greater than 50% discount to cash. The easy sort of catalyst in place was the market's recognition that this asset, that you were getting the assets for free and that it was selling for 60% of cash in the treasury. I mean, that was the last one I had.
Well, Rick, I appreciate your time. When we were in Vancouver over the summer, the last question I asked you was, what Rick Ruhlism should we most be aware of and apply to our investing at the time? And I believe you said that we must be a contrarian or we'll be a victim. Is that still the number one Rick Ruhlism for you right now?
Yeah, I think it is. I think another Rick Ruhlism that I tried to get across at that conference, and it isn't really a Rick Ruhlism, but I'd love to take credit for it, is simply knowing yourself as an investor and knowing what you're about gives you the courage of time. One of the things I've learned, and this is sort of amusing to me, as I get older and I have less time on earth, I become much more patient. And I think that's a consequence of knowing myself in the investment process. In particular, when I have a question in front of me where I know that the answer begins with when, in other words, I know it's going to occur, rather than a question where the answer begins with if, that is the fact that it might occur. When questions, even having to give up the time preference, are much higher quality questions than if questions. Now, related to investments, an example would be for me in the uranium business, where I know that it costs the industry $60 a pound fully loaded, including cost of capital, to make the stuff, and they sell it for $30 a pound. In other words, they lose $30 a pound, and they repeat this 80 or 85 million times a year. That gets sort of boring. I also know that uranium is a critical component of baseload electrical generation worldwide. So the question comes down to, will the uranium price rise to the cost of production over 6 or 7 years, or will the lights go off? It can only be one or the other. I believe that the lights aren't going to go off, which means that I think the uranium prices are going to rise to $60 or $65 a pound. The question then becomes, when is that going to occur? You juxtapose that with a more popular question in mineral exploration, which is, what will the result of a drill hole be? Very much an if question, but one that gets settled positively or negatively in 60 to 90 days. It's ironic to me that people's time preferences are so extraordinarily short-sighted that people would rather take a 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 risk, knowing the time, than invest money in what is a certainty, but where you don't have the advantage of time. I guess one of the things that's made me a success in the last 30 years is I've come to appreciate when questions relative to if questions.
And those are the best investment opportunities to average down on, aren't they? If you're going to average down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, Buffett talks about averaging down as a very good thing. He says if you've spent the time and attention to understand an investment well enough to buy some, you should be delighted to see it fall in price 20 or 30% after you've purchased it so that you can use the same knowledge to buy more for a lower price. Now, the truth is I've been tested with that numerous times in my career, and it's seldom pleasant, but mostly profitable.
Rick, before you go, is there anything going on with Sprott or any offerings you'd like to make the listeners aware of?
Most of what we do here involves fairly bespoke questions between ourselves and our customers. One special offer that we'd like to make to your listeners, which we've made in the past, is if they like what they heard today, I offer an absolutely no obligation natural resource portfolio review. If your listeners would like me to rate and rank the natural resource stocks in their portfolio, they should send me those in an email. It's important that both the name and the symbol be in the text of an email, not in some attachment, which I may or may not be able to open, and that they send me that email to rrule, that's R-R-U-L-E, at sprottglobal.com. I will rank and return those portfolios. Note that this isn't investment advice because I don't understand all aspects of those people as investors. Rather, these are company rankings.
Rick, I appreciate your time today. Thank you for stopping by and sharing your insights.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for the great questions.
For millennia, ancient pharaohs prospered from unparalleled riches made possible by Egypt's resource-rich gold deposits. But despite this rich history, modern Egypt remains one of the most underdeveloped gold mining countries in the world. But that's all about to change. Aton Resources is leading the charge on the Egyptian mining revival. As the only public exploration company in Egypt, Aton Resources has first mover advantage. Focused on their 100% owned Abu Marawat concession, Aton Resources is advancing several exploration targets, including the recent discovery of the legendary Lost Mountain of Gold at Rod Ruin. Learn more about this exciting drill program and other news at AtonResources.com. Aton trades on the TSXV under the ticker symbol AAN and on the OTC under the ticker ANLBF. Thank you for listening to this Mining Stock Education podcast. Please subscribe and share with like-minded investors. Visit us on the web at miningstockeducation.com for more resources on precious metals and natural resource investing. At our website, you can also sign up for our free newsletter for interview transcripts, stock picks, and more. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.